My mother always taught me that my best friend's dad was a monster. When I found out the truth, I told her, but she tried to silence me and move us away. So I started digging even deeper and found the most disturbing secret that I'll never forget. I was 12 when Brian joined my class. He was tall, played sports, he should have been liked and popular, but instead the whole class went ghost white as soon as he walked in. The teacher herself even went pale. I was clearly the only one who was out of the loop. I sat down next to him during lunch either way, and everyone, including Brian himself, gave me a weird look. "You actually want to be my friend?" he asked, all surprised. We spent our whole day having a blast. I didn't have any friends at the time, so I went home excited to tell my mom about the new one I had made, but when I told her his name, her face went white. "Stay away from that kid. Him and his dad are monsters. They hit and hospitalized their mom." I was shocked. The next morning, Mom drove me to school instead of letting me walk. She marched right up to my teacher and whispered something that made Mrs. Squelch nod grimly. When I tried to sit near Brian in class, Mrs. Squelch moved my seat. I took one look at Brian from across the classroom, and I saw him nearly tearing up. During recess, he stood alone by the fence while everyone else played, and after school, I saw why. Brian's dad pulled up and the entire pickup area cleared out. Parents grabbed their kids and speedwalked to their cars. One mom actually said, "Don't look at him, sweetie," to her daughter. Brian's dad just sat there with his head down while Brian climbed in. Everyone treated him like they were awful, but it didn't add up. Brian's dad would pack Brian extra granola bars for kids who forgot lunch money, and Brian voluntarily stayed after school to tutor special needs kids. There was just no way this was the family who hit their own mother. Then came the day I realized who Brian and his father really were. I was walking home counting the $50 my grandma gave me for my birthday when 3 8th graders surrounded me. "Look at the rich boy," the biggest one said, and shoved me to the ground. They grabbed my money and one of them kicked me in the ribs. I curled up waiting for more when suddenly they all scrambled away. Brian's dad stood there, not touching anyone, just standing. "You okay, kid?" he asked before helping me up. He walked me home without saying much else. When I told Mom what happened, she completely lost it. "He approached you? What if he'd taken you somewhere?" She called the school immediately. "A known abuser confronted my son," she kept saying. By the next day, the whole school knew. The principal sent out an email banning Brian's dad from school property. Parents shared it on Facebook, calling him a predator who lurked around children. At school, Brian looked destroyed. He sat with his head on his desk most of the day. When I tried to slip him a note saying thanks for his dad helping me, he pushed it back. "Please don't," he whispered. "You're making things worse for him." 2 weeks later, I saw Brian crying in the library. He was trying to hide it, but his shoulders were shaking. I sat down anyway. "They spray-painted predator on his car," Brian said. "He lost his job because of it. We might lose our apartment." He wiped his eyes hard. "Everyone hates him, but they don't know anything." "What do you mean?" I asked. Brian looked around to make sure we were alone. He then dropped the bomb. Turns out, him and his dad never hit their mom. In fact, it was the other way around. Their mom hit them. She'd throw bottles, smash pans, plates, use lighters. Brian still has a burn mark on his back from that. "Then why was your dad blamed?" I asked him. That's when he just broke down crying. He revealed that this mom, on top of hitting them, always threatened his dad, saying if he ever left and took Brian, then she'd tell everyone dad was the abuser. My face went pale. "And that's what she did," Brian said, crying. "When dad took me and we finally left, she took him to court and lied about everything." "Then why does everyone say you are guilty?" "Abuse your all-thing idiots who can't do a Google search." He then pulled out his phone and showed me something that changed everything I ever believed about them. He showed me screenshots of police reports, court documents, and medical records. There were photos of bruises on his dad's arms, a hospital report from when his mom threw a glass bottle at his head, and multiple restraining order applications his dad had filed but withdrawn. The dates went back years. Brian scrolled through photo after photo, each one making my stomach turn more. I grabbed his phone and started taking pictures with mine. Brian tried to stop me, but I shook my head. "People need to see this." "No!" Brian snatched his phone back. "You don't get it. She'll make it worse. She always does." The bell rang and we had to go to class. I couldn't concentrate on anything. Every time I looked at Brian hunched over his desk, I thought about those photos, about his dad sitting in his car with spray paint calling him a predator, about how everyone, including my own mom, believed the lie. After school, Mom was waiting in the pickup line. She barely let me get in before starting. "I heard you were talking to that Brian kid in the library. What did I tell you?" "Mom, you don't understand. No discussion. You're staying away from him." She gripped the steering wheel tighter. "His father is dangerous. The whole community knows it." "But what if they're wrong?" I pulled out my phone. "What if I could show you?" Mom slammed on the brakes at a red light and turned to me. "Whatever sob story they fed you, I don't want to hear it. Abusers always claim to be victims. Always." At home, I went straight to my room and started researching. I found the court case online. Public records showed Brian's mom had won full custody initially, but then Brian chose to live with his dad when he turned 12. That's when she filed the abuse claims. The timing seemed suspicious. I created a document on my computer, organizing everything. The photos from Brian's phone, the court timeline, the fact that Brian's dad had never been actually convicted of anything, just accused. I was deep in research when Mom appeared in my doorway. "What are you doing?" I minimized the window. "Homework." She walked over and reopened it. Her face went from confused to furious in seconds. "You took pictures of their fake evidence? Are you insane? It's not fake. Look at the dates. Look at the—" "Delete it. Now." When I hesitated, she grabbed my phone. "I'm keeping this until you learn to make better choices. And you're grounded. No computer except for homework. And I'll be checking." The next few days were torture. At school, I tried to slip Brian notes, but teachers kept separating us. Kids started whispering when I walked by. "That's the kid who hangs out with the abuser's son," I heard someone say. I started using the library computers during lunch. The librarian, Mrs. Chen, didn't pay much attention as long as you were quiet. I dug deeper into public records. Brian's mom, Catherine, had quite a history. 2 previous restraining orders from ex-boyfriends. An arrest for assault at a bar. All before she met Brian's dad. I was printing pages when someone cleared their throat behind me. Mrs. Patterson, the nosiest parent volunteer, stood there with her arms crossed. "Shouldn't you be at lunch?" I grabbed the papers and stuffed them in my backpack, just finishing homework. That afternoon, Mom was waiting in the principal's office when I got called down. Mrs. Patterson sat beside her, looking smug. Principal Morrison held up the printed pages. "Care to explain why you're researching restraining orders during school hours?" Mom's face was stone. "We'll discuss discuss this at home. The car ride was silent until we pulled into our driveway. Then Mom exploded. Mrs. Patterson told me everything. You're obsessed with defending these people. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with everyone else? I shouted back. You're destroying an innocent family because you're too stubborn to look at evidence. Go to your room. You're not leaving this house except for school until you get your head straight. I stomped upstairs and slammed my door. Outside my window, I could see Mrs. Patterson's house across the street. She was probably already texting the other moms about my concerning behavior. At school the next day, it was worse. Kids moved away when I sat down. My usual lunch table was suddenly full. Even teachers looked at me differently. Brian caught my eye in the hallway and mouthed, "I'm sorry." I ate lunch alone in the bathroom stall, planning my next move. Mom had taken my phone and restricted my computer access, but she couldn't stop me from using school resources. I just had to be smarter about it. Over the next week, I developed a routine. I'd volunteer to help teachers after school, then use their computers when they stepped out. I found more about Catherine. She'd been fired from 3 jobs for interpersonal conflicts. Her social media, before it went private, was full of rants about ex-boyfriends who'd wronged her. Brian started leaving me notes in library books, small updates about his dad. Lost another job interview when they Googled him. Landlord wants us out by end of month. Dad won't eat. Says food should go to me. Each note made me angrier. I started writing everything down in a notebook I kept hidden in my locker. Evidence, dates, connections. I was building a case. Then Mom found out about the after-school computer use. Mrs. Patterson's daughter had seen me and reported back. Mom showed up at school, furious. "I've had enough," she told Principal Morrison. "I'm concerned about the influence this family has on my son. He's lying, sneaking around, obsessing over them." Principal Morrison nodded gravely. "We've noticed changes in his behavior, too. I want assurance that my son will have no contact with Brian at school. We'll do our best to monitor the situation." They moved my classes so I wouldn't see Brian. They assigned me a different lunch period. A guidance counselor started pulling me out of class for check-ins, where she'd ask how I was feeling and if I wanted to talk about my recent choices. But they couldn't stop me from thinking, from planning, from knowing that somewhere in town, Brian and his dad were suffering because everyone chose comfortable lies over uncomfortable truth. One day, I saw Brian's dad at the grocery store. He was buying the cheapest bread and a jar of peanut butter. His clothes hung loose like he'd lost weight. When he saw me, he quickly looked away and headed for checkout. I followed him outside. "Mr. Davidson?" He stopped but didn't turn around. "You shouldn't talk to me. It'll make things worse for you." "I know the truth." Brian showed me. His shoulders sagged. "The truth doesn't matter when no one wants to hear it. I want to help." He finally turned. His eyes were red-rimmed, exhausted. "You're a good kid, but stay away from us. For your own sake." He drove off in his car, Predator still faintly visible under a layer of cheap paint. That night, Mom came to my room with her laptop. "I want to show you something." She pulled up the parent Facebook group, post after post about Brian's dad. Saw him lurking near the playground. He followed my daughter in the store. "Why isn't he in jail yet?" "These are lies," I said. "He's just existing and they're making it sound criminal." 300 parents can't all be wrong. Mom closed the laptop. "I'm trying to protect you. This man is manipulating you through his son. You're the one being manipulated by gossip and fear and—" "Enough," Mom stood up. "I've made appointments with a therapist, someone who specializes in children who've been influenced by dangerous individuals." My blood ran cold. "You think I'm brainwashed?" "I think you're confused, and I'm going to fix this." She left me alone with my rage. They were building walls around me, trying to force me to abandon Brian and his dad, but walls had never stopped me before. Late that night, I heard Mom on the phone. "Yes, I'm very concerned. He's obsessed with proving their innocence, taking pictures of supposed evidence. I think they've really gotten into his head." I recognized the careful tone. She was building her own case, making me sound unstable, obsessed, manipulated, the same playbook Catherine had used against Brian's dad. I stared at my ceiling, thinking. Everyone believed the story because it was easier than questioning it, because a mother's tears in court were more compelling than a father's quiet denials, because once the narrative was set, changing it meant admitting you'd been wrong, and nobody wanted to admit they'd helped destroy an innocent family. But I had time, I had determination, and most importantly, I had the truth. They could take my phone, restrict my computer, separate me from Brian at school. They could whisper about me, isolate me, even send me to therapy, but they couldn't change what I knew. Brian's dad was innocent. Brian was suffering, and somehow, I was going to prove it to everyone, even if it meant becoming a pariah myself, even if it meant fighting my own mother, even if the whole town turned against me, because sometimes the truth is worth becoming the villain in everyone else's story. The next morning, I woke up with a plan. It was risky, probably stupid, and would definitely get me in more trouble. But Brian's latest note had said they had 2 weeks before eviction. 2 weeks to change everything, 2 weeks to expose Catherine's lies, 2 weeks to save my friend's family. I got dressed for school, kissed Mom goodbye like nothing was wrong, and mentally prepared for war. They thought they'd broken me with isolation and therapy threats. They had no idea what I was capable of when I knew I was right. The therapy appointment was scheduled for Thursday, 3 days to work with. I walked into school that morning with my notebook tucked under my shirt, knowing Mrs. Patterson's daughter would be watching my every move. During first period, I asked to use the bathroom and instead slipped into the computer lab. The room was empty except for a seventh grader working on a project. I logged into a terminal in the corner and pulled up Catherine's social media profiles using a fake account I'd created weeks ago. Her posts from 3 years ago painted a different picture than the grieving mother everyone saw now. Photos at bars, angry rants about deadbeat men, and one particularly telling post. "Some people just need to learn their lesson the hard way. I always get what I want in the end." I screenshot everything and emailed it to a new account before the bell rang. As I headed back to class, I noticed Brian wasn't in his usual spot. His desk sat empty. At lunch, I found his note in our usual book. "Dad collapsed yesterday. Not eating enough. Hospital won't admit him. No insurance. We're sleeping in the car now." My hands shook as I read it. They were living in their car while Catherine probably sat comfortable in the house Brian's dad had paid for. I had to move faster. After school, I told Mom I was staying for math tutoring. She'd verify with the teacher later, but that gave me an hour. I ran to the public library 6 blocks away. The computers there didn't require student logins. I'd been researching for 20 minutes when Catherine walked in. She looked nothing like the broken woman from the court photos. Designer clothes, fresh manicure, confident stride. She headed straight for the fiction section, and I I ducked behind my monitor. My heart pounded as she browsed, occasionally glancing around. Was she here by coincidence, or had someone told her about my library visits? She left after 10 minutes, but I couldn't shake the feeling she'd seen me. I packed up and took a different route home, cutting through the park. Mom was waiting on the porch. Math tutoring ended an hour ago. I walked with some friends. Mrs. Patterson saw you at the library. She held up her phone, showing a photo of me at the computer. She's concerned you're still investigating that family. I stayed silent as she ushered me inside. The therapy appointment couldn't come fast enough for her. That night, I heard arguing downstairs. Dad had come home from his business trip, and Mom was filling him in. He's obsessed, Tom, taking pictures of documents, researching the mother, defending them constantly. Maybe we should hear him out, Dad said quietly. What if there's more to the story? Not you too, Mom's voice rose. That man is dangerous. The whole community knows it. The whole community has been wrong before, Dad replied. Their argument continued, but I had hope. Dad had always been more logical, less swayed by gossip. Maybe I could convince him. The next morning, Brian wasn't at school again. I overheard teachers saying he'd been absent 3 days now. Probably too embarrassed to show his face, one said, after what his father did. I wanted to scream that they had it backwards, but I kept quiet. Let them think I'd given up. During library time, I found a note in our book, but it wasn't Brian's handwriting. Stop digging or your friend pays the price. Kay. Catherine knew. She knew I was investigating her. My hands trembled as I pocketed the note. This was escalating beyond parent drama and school gossip. After school, I convinced Dad to drive me past Brian's old apartment. The car wasn't in the parking lot. We checked 3 other lots before I spotted it behind a grocery store. Brian's dad was slumped in the driver's seat, and Brian was curled up in the back. Dad, please, I begged. Look at them. Does that look like a dangerous man to you? Dad stared for a long moment. Get back in the car. But instead of driving home, he pulled into the grocery store. He bought 2 bags of groceries and a hot rotisserie chicken. Stay here, he told me. I watched him approach their car and knock gently on the window. Brian's dad jerked awake, fear flashing across his face. But Dad just held up the bags. They talked for a few minutes, Brian's dad shaking his head repeatedly. Finally, Dad left the groceries on their hood and walked back. He wouldn't take them at first, Dad said as we drove away. Said he didn't want charity. I told him it wasn't charity, just one father helping another. That night, Dad and Mom had another argument. But this time, I heard Dad say, what if we're wrong, Janet? What if we're destroying an innocent family? Thursday came too fast. The therapist's office smelled like vanilla candles and had inspirational posters on every wall. Dr. Reeves looked exactly like I'd expected. Wire-rimmed glasses, sympathetic smile, notebook ready. Your mother tells me you've been defending a classmate whose father has a concerning history, she began. I chose my words carefully. I've seen evidence that the story everyone believes might not be true. Sometimes when we care about someone, we want to believe the best about them, she said gently. But that can blind us to red flags. What if the red flags are pointing at the wrong person? We went in circles for an hour. She'd suggest I was being manipulated. I'd counter with facts. She'd talk about trusting community judgment. I'd point out communities have been wrong before. By the end, she looked frustrated. I'd like to see you weekly, she told Mom. He's showing signs of oppositional defiance. Great, now I had a label. Friday morning, I found Brian at school. He looked terrible. Unwashed clothes, hollow eyes, hands shaking slightly. You okay? I whispered as I passed. He shook his head minutely. She called Dad yesterday. Said she'd drop the restraining order if we came back. Dad said no. She got angry. What did she do? Nothing yet. That's what scares me. During lunch, I used a teacher's computer while she was at a meeting. I told her I needed to print homework. Instead, I logged into the email account where I'd been saving evidence. There was a new message. No sender name, just, you were warned. Attached was a photo of me at the library computer, taken from behind. Catherine had been watching me that day. My phone buzzed with a text from an unknown number. Mom had taken my phone, but I'd hidden my old one in my locker. Your friend looks tired. Sleeping in cars is so dangerous. Anything could happen. I screenshot the threat and added it to my evidence file. Catherine was getting bolder. That afternoon, Principal Morrison called me to his office. Mom was there, along with Mrs. Patterson and 2 other parent volunteers. We're concerned about your behavior, Morrison began. Multiple parents have reported seeing you researching private information about a family in our community. I'm trying to help them, I said. By spreading lies? Mrs. Patterson leaned forward. That poor woman has suffered enough without you dragging her name through the mud. Have any of you actually looked at the evidence? I asked. Or are you just believing what you want to believe? Mom's face flushed. Apologize. Now, for what? Asking questions? The meeting devolved from there. They talked about suspension, about limiting my computer access at school, about the therapy being increased to 2x weekly. I sat silent, letting them plan my punishment while Brian and his dad slept in their car. That night, I heard Mom on the phone with Catherine. I'm so sorry for what my son has been doing. Yes, we're handling it. No, he won't bother you anymore. Of course, if there's anything else. She was apologizing to the abuser, promising to silence me. I wanted to scream. Saturday morning, Dad took me to get a haircut. On the way, he said quietly, I drove by that grocery store again last night. They're still there. Because they have nowhere else to go. Your mother means well, he said. She's trying to protect you. From what? From helping innocent people? Dad was quiet for a long moment. Show me your evidence. I stared at him. Really? I'm willing to look, but if I'm not convinced, you drop this. Deal? I agreed immediately. That night, while Mom was at book club, I showed Dad everything. The photos Brian had shared, the court documents, Catherine's social media posts, her history of restraining orders, the threatening messages. Dad studied each piece carefully. His expression grew more troubled with each page. This is substantial, he finally said. So you believe me? I believe there's more to this story than we've been told. He rubbed his face. But your mother will never accept this. Neither will the community. They've invested too much in their version. So we just let them suffer? I didn't say that. Dad looked thoughtful. But we need to be smart about this. Catherine clearly knows you're investigating. These threats. We should go to the police. With what? She's careful. Nothing directly threatening enough for them to act on. Dad's phone rang. Mom was calling to say book club was ending early. He quickly helped me hide the evidence. We'll figure something out, he promised. But be careful. Don't do anything reckless. Sunday passed quietly. Too quietly. No notes from Brian. No threats from Catherine. The calm made me nervous. Monday morning, everything exploded. I arrived at school to find police cars in the parking lot. Students clustered in groups, whispering excitedly. I pushed through until I could see what was happening. Brian's dad was in handcuffs. Brian stood beside outside a police car, tears streaming down his face. Catherine was there too, holding a bloody tissue to her nose, talking animatedly to an officer. "He attacked me," she was saying. "I just wanted to talk about our son, and he went crazy." I knew immediately what had happened. She'd provoked him somehow, maybe hurt herself, and called the police. Classic abuser tactic, provoke a reaction, then play victim. "That's not true," I shouted, pushing forward. "She's lying!" An officer stopped me. "Stay back, son." "But I have evidence. She's the abuser, not him." Catherine's eyes found mine over the officer's shoulder. She smiled slightly, triumphantly. They put Brian's dad in the police car. Brian tried to go with him, but Catherine grabbed his arm. "You're coming home with me, sweetheart, where you belong." "No," Brian tried to pull away. "I won't go with you. He's my son," Catherine told the officers. "I have custody. He's just confused because his father has been filling his head with lies. They made Brian go with her." I watched helplessly as she led him to her car, her grip tight on his arm. He looked back at me, terrified. At home, I told Dad everything. He immediately called a lawyer friend, but the news wasn't good. With Catherine's new accusation, Brian's dad would likely be held at least overnight, and with existing custody orders, Catherine had every right to take Brian. "We need those threats she sent," Dad said. "They show she's been planning this." But when I checked my hidden phone, the messages were gone. Somehow, she'd remotely deleted them. I still had the screenshots on my email, but would anyone believe they were real? That night, I lay awake thinking about Brian in that house with her. Was she hurting him? Was he okay? Tuesday morning, Brian wasn't at school. I overheard teachers saying Catherine had called to say he was traumatized and needed time to readjust. I knew better. She was keeping him prisoner. During lunch, I snuck out. I know I'd promised Dad not to be reckless, but I couldn't leave Brian there. I ran the 8 blocks to Catherine's house. The curtains were drawn, but I could hear shouting inside, then a crash, then Brian's voice, high and scared. "Please, Mom, I'm sorry." I called 911 from my hidden phone. "I think someone's being hurt at 438 Maple Street. I can hear screaming and things breaking." I waited behind a tree until the police arrived. They knocked, and Catherine answered, looking perfectly composed. "Officers, is something wrong? We received a call about a disturbance." "Oh, that must have been the TV. I was watching an action movie. Sorry if it was too loud." They bought it. They actually bought it. I wanted to scream that Brian was in there, probably hurt, but I knew they'd just call my parents. After they left, Catherine stepped onto her porch and looked directly at where I was hiding. "I know you're there," she called sweetly. "Brian wants to tell you something." Brian appeared in the doorway. Even from a distance, I could see the red mark on his cheek. "Stop trying to help," he said woodenly. "You're making everything worse. Just leave us alone." Catherine's hand was on his shoulder, squeezing. He was reading from a script. I ran back to school, arriving just as lunch ended. My teacher marked me tardy, but I didn't care. I had to do something. That afternoon, I made a decision. If the adults wouldn't listen to evidence, maybe they'd listen to Brian himself. I started recording videos on my hidden phone, documenting everything. The dates, the timeline, the threats I'd screenshot before they were deleted. "My name is Narrator," I began, "and I'm about to tell you the truth about Catherine Davidson." I uploaded it to YouTube that night, then shared the link anonymously in the parent Facebook group. Within an hour, it had 50 views, then 100. Then Mom burst into my room. "What have you done?" The video was already being discussed in the group. Some parents were calling me a liar, but others were asking questions. Why would a 12-year-old make this up? What did he have to gain? "You're grounded indefinitely," Mom said. "No school, no leaving the house, nothing until you take that video down. Number, excuse me?" I said no. "Ground me forever if you want, but that video stays up." Dad appeared in the doorway. "Janet, have you watched it?" "I don't need to watch lies about that poor woman." "I watched it," Dad said quietly. "And I think we need to consider that our son might be telling the truth." They argued for an hour. Mom accused Dad of enabling my delusions. Dad pointed out the evidence I'd presented. Finally, Mom stormed out, saying she was staying at her sister's until this family came to its senses. Wednesday morning, the video had 2,000 views. Comments poured in. Some people called me a brat, but others shared their own stories of false accusations, of how hard it was for male abuse victims to be believed. Then Catherine struck back. A new video appeared on the parent Facebook page. Security footage from a store, showing me stalking her at the library. Another of me, lurking outside her house. She'd edited them to remove context, making me look obsessed and dangerous. "This disturbed child has been harassing my family," her post read. "His father should be investigated for encouraging this behavior. I fear for my safety and my son's." The tide turned against us immediately. Parents demanded action. Some called for Dad to be fired from his job for enabling stalking. Others wanted me institutionalized. Principal Morrison called Dad. I was suspended indefinitely pending a psychological evaluation. The therapy appointments were now mandatory, not optional. But something unexpected happened. Brian's dad's lawyer saw my video. He called Dad that afternoon. "Your son's video is the first real help we've gotten," he said. "Would he testify about what he's witnessed?" "He's 12, Dad said, "and the community has already turned against him." "I understand, but that video is making people outside your community ask questions. Sometimes that's all it takes, one crack in the narrative." That night, I couldn't sleep. Brian was still trapped with Catherine, his dad was still in jail, and now my family was falling apart too. But that video was still up, still spreading. Maybe it would reach someone who could help. Thursday brought a breakthrough from an unexpected source. A woman named Sarah commented on my video. "Catherine Davidson was my roommate in college. Everything this kid is saying tracks with what I saw. She put her ex-boyfriend in the hospital and convinced everyone he was the aggressor. I have photos." Sarah's comment included pictures from 20 years ago. Catherine with bruised knuckles, laughing about teaching him a lesson. Police reports where she was listed as the aggressor, but talked her way out of charges. I screenshot everything before Catherine could get it removed. But Sarah did more than comment. She called the police department where Brian's dad was being held. She called local news stations. She called anyone who would listen. "I stayed quiet 20 years ago," she told a reporter. "I won't make that mistake again." By Friday, cracks were showing in Catherine's story. The security footage she'd posted was being questioned. Why was she filming a child? How did she have footage from multiple locations? It seemed more like stalking than being stalked. Brian's dad's lawyer used my video and Sarah's testimony to request an emergency custody hearing. A judge agreed to review the case Monday, but Catherine wasn't done. Friday afternoon, she called Dad's work, claiming he'd threatened her. She had a recording, cleverly edited from a voicemail he'd left asking her to let Brian return to school. Dad's boss called him in. There would be an investigation. investigation. In the meantime, Dad was suspended with pay. I'm sorry, I told him that night. I ruined everything. No, Dad said firmly. You stood up for the truth. That's never wrong, even when it costs us. Mom still wasn't home. She'd texted Dad that she wouldn't return until I got help for my obsession. Our family was fractured, just like Brian's. Saturday, I spent the day refreshing the video stats. 50,000 views now. News outlets were picking it up. Local boys' video sparks debate about believing abuse victims, read one headline. The comment section was a battlefield. Catherine's supporters called me a monster, but more people were sharing their own stories. Men who'd been abused and not believed. Children who'd watched their fathers destroyed by false accusations. The narrative was shifting. Then Sarah posted again. This time, she had video. Old camcorder footage from College of Catherine, admitting she'd lied about her boyfriend. He was going to leave me, Catherine said in the grainy video. So I made sure nobody would believe him when he tried. The smoking GN. I downloaded it immediately. Backed it up everywhere I could think of. This was the proof everyone needed. But Catherine made one last desperate play. Saturday night, she posted on Facebook that Brian had run away. My troubled son has been so brainwashed by his father's lies that he's fled our home. Please help me find him. Police issued an alert. The whole town was looking for Brian. Catherine played the desperate mother perfectly, even doing a tearful interview with local news. I knew better. Brian wouldn't run away. He had nowhere to go. Which meant Catherine had done something with him, hidden him somewhere to make her story believable. I called the police with my theory, but they dismissed me. The boy who'd made the video was not a credible source, they said. So I did the only thing I could think of. I went live on social media. Brian Davidson didn't run away, I said to my phone camera. His mother is hiding him somewhere. She's done this before. Sarah's evidence proves it. Brian is in danger. Please, someone help find him. The live video spread faster than anything I'd posted before. People started sharing Brian's photo, but not with Catherine's narrative. They shared it with warnings. This boy may be held against his will by his mother. Tips poured in. Someone had seen Catherine's car at an abandoned property outside town. Another reported strange noises from a storage unit she rented. The police, faced with mounting public pressure, had to investigate. They found Brian locked in Catherine's storage unit with a sleeping bag and some water. She'd told him if he left, she'd call his father. The news broke Sunday morning. Catherine was arrested. Brian was safe, traumatized, but physically unharmed. The footage of police leading Catherine away in handcuffs while she screamed about conspiracy was everywhere. But the real vindication came when they reviewed Brian's medical records with fresh eyes. The pattern was clear. Injuries consistent with abuse, all from before his parents separated, all from when he lived primarily with Catherine. Brian's dad was released immediately. The charges were dropped. The reunion video of Brian running into his father's arms went viral. The community that had condemned them was forced to confront an uncomfortable truth. They'd been wrong. They'd chosen comfortable lies over uncomfortable evidence. They'd nearly destroyed an innocent family because believing a mother's tears was easier than questioning the narrative. Some apologized. Principal Morrison personally called to lift my suspension and Brian's dad's school ban. Mrs. Patterson, surprisingly, showed up at our door with a casserole and tearful regret. But others doubled down, insisting Catherine was still the real victim, that we'd all been fooled. The parent Facebook group split into factions. Friendships ended. The community that had been so united in their hatred was now divided by truth. Mom came home Sunday night. She stood in the doorway of my room for a long moment before speaking. I was wrong, she said simply. I was so focused on protecting you that I refused to see what was right in front of me. You were doing what you thought was right, I said. No, she shook her head. I was doing what was easy. Believing what everyone else believed because questioning it was too hard. Our family started healing, slowly. The therapy sessions Dr. Reeves had insisted on became family sessions where we actually worked through what had happened. Brian and his dad found a new apartment with help from a GoFundMe that Sarah started. The same community that had shunned them now donated thousands to help them start over. At school, things were different. Some kids treated me like a hero. Others whispered that I was a troublemaker who'd destroyed a family. Brian and I ate lunch together, no longer caring what anyone thought. Thank you, he said one day, for not giving up, even when it cost you everything. You would have done the same for me, I replied. I don't know if I would have been brave enough, he admitted. To stand alone against everyone? To keep fighting when your own family turned against you? That took real courage. Catherine's trial was months away, but her reputation was destroyed. The truth had finally caught up with her carefully constructed lies. She'd lost her son, her freedom, and the sympathy she'd weaponized for so long. But the real victory wasn't her downfall. It was Brian's smile returning. It was his dad getting a new job without whispers following him. It was a community slowly learning that sometimes the truth is more complex than the story they want to believe. I learned something too. Standing up for truth isn't easy. It costs you friends, divides families, makes you question everything. But when you know you're right, when someone's life hangs in the balance, you keep going. Even if it means becoming the villain in everyone else's story. Because sometimes, that's what heroes have to do. Monday morning brought chaos. The emergency custody hearing was scheduled for 2 p.m., but Catherine wasn't going down without a fight. She'd hired three lawyers and launched a media blitz overnight, appearing on morning shows claiming she was being persecuted by an online mob. I watched from my bedroom as she cried on TV about how her disturbed ex-husband had turned their son against her. She held up printed screenshots of my video, calling it harassment. The host nodded sympathetically while Catherine painted herself as a victim of cyberbullying. Dad knocked on my door. The lawyer wants to prep you for testimony. You ready for this? I nodded, but my hands were shaking. One thing was posting videos online, another was facing Catherine in court. We met Brian's dad's lawyer, Mr. Chen, at his office. He looked exhausted, but determined. Your video changed everything, he told me. But Catherine's team will try to discredit you. They'll say you're just a kid who got manipulated. What should I say? The truth. Stick to facts, not opinions. And whatever you do, don't let them rattle you. Brian was there too, sitting between his dad and a social worker. He looked better than when I'd seen him at Catherine's house, but there were still shadows under his eyes. The social worker kept writing notes every time Brian moved. They're evaluating me, Brian whispered when she stepped out, to see if I'm being coached. The courthouse was packed. Parents from school filled the gallery, divided into clear camps. Mrs. Patterson sat behind Catherine, while surprisingly, Mrs. Chen from the library sat on our side. Local news cameras waited outside. Catherine entered looking looking perfectly composed in a conservative suit, dabbing at her eyes with a tissue. She'd even brought props, a photo album of happier times with Brian that she clutched dramatically. The judge, a stern woman named Rodriguez, called the hearing to order. Catherine's lawyers immediately moved to exclude my testimony, calling me an emotionally disturbed child with an unhealthy obsession. Your Honor, one lawyer, at this point you stalked my client, posted defamatory videos, and encouraged a hate campaign against the protective mother, Mr. Chen. Your Honor, this boy uncovered evidence of systematic abuse that shows my client's testimony proves Judge Rodriguez' claim to be crazy.